for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Hudson River. My name is Ra, and I'm here to awaken the dormant particles that are spiraling inside your DNA. So come with me as we go further down the mystical spiral of life. It's Spiral Radio, where each and every week we unveil the different shades of you and the different shades of me until we all vibrate the same frequency. We got a Capricorn moon out tonight. It's a beautiful night here in New York on the Hudson River. And my guest you can find at Genesis 6. That's the number 6, Genesis6Conspiracy.com. He's been a regular here on Spiral Radio, and his name is Gary Wayne. And if you're looking to find Spiral Radio, you can find us here on the Para-X Radio Network. And you can also find us at themysticalspiral.com. So our hour is going to go by really quick, so I really want to bring my guest on. My buddy Gary Wayne is an author and a researcher, and you can find his book, Genesis 6 Conspiracy, at his website of the same name and on Amazon and various other places. And tonight we are going to be talking about ancient Lake Nemi and the giants and the ancient lore associated with it and how it ties into even some Celtic lore as well. And I want to welcome back to Spiral Radio my buddy Gary Wayne. Welcome back, Gary.
Well, so happy to be back and really looking forward to what we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, there's for sure been giants in the past. I mean, skeletons have been found. You know, it's been in all ancient lore. I mean, so things like this, it can't be just made up. It can't just be something pulled out of the air. So it is historical fact that we had giants. The size of them is what is you know, we can't always prove. And it's funny that throughout the years, I mean, they've found 11, 15, even 20-foot skeletons places. And all of a sudden, these skeletons seem to disappear. And, you know, whether it's the Smithsonian or wherever it goes, that there's been proof throughout the years. I mean, in the early 1900s, wasn't there like a rash of skeletons found?
Oh, there was a significant number of found, and they're recorded in so many newspaper articles, and
yeah.
Either went to a university and then to the Smithsonian or directly to the Smithsonian, and they're never heard of from again. And
yeah.
I post a lot of those newspaper articles, you know, on my Facebook page every once in a while. I'll do a couple every month type of thing.
Yeah, and Twitter too, right? You have the Twitter, I've noticed too. You have...
Yep. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's to me, it's a fact, and it's something that the information is being controlled on. And, you know, we have recollections from, you know, Roman history of, you know, 10-foot giants, 11-foot giants. We have recollections all the way back through almost all of the cultures. And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's just, it's so common. It's one of those common sort of historical, right through to prehistory, standard that's in all cultures. And it just can't be just dismissed as being imaginative or a fictional creation, because the storylines and the descriptions are the same. So they either have an exact same source, or there's multiple varieties that were created in a similar way.
And the thing is, I mean, these Nephilim, these ancient giants, I mean, even though we're not seeing physical giants around today, the bloodline still exists, right? And I think it's sort of what's ruling our world, our planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot of what my book is about. And
yes.
So to bring the listener up to what we might be talking about here, or what we are talking about here, is that these giants, not only before in the ancient times before the flood usurped the kingships, but also after the flood. And again, this is not an uncommon understanding in early prehistory after the flood. And so they usurp all of the dynasties, and those dynasties produced all of the royal dynasties that we've seen for the most part throughout our history. And some of them, and many of them, are still around today, and those bloodlines are still around today. You've got bloodlines that go right back to the Xia dynasty and the sovereign heavenly dragons of China with the Li dynasty. And of course, you have a Li that's still ruling China today.
Yeah.
These bloodlines don't go away.
Yeah, they've also been known to like harness dragon power, you know, and these ancient dragons are also associated with these giants. And it's interesting. Even some tales are saying that the red haired bloodline, like the red hair traits and certain red hair lines, may even come from these Nephilim as well.
Well, there was two strains of that. So you have the blonde haired, blue eyed, pale skinned giants, and you have the red haired, hazel eyed, pale skinned giants, and they're just two branches of the same tree. They just have different skin colors, and they migrated after the flood, which is another story in itself, in basically, you know, a couple of different directions. So red hair is a standard in the descriptions and understanding of giants and the linkage throughout history.
Yeah, and it's even like the size of them. I mean, even the ones that were found in like these newspaper articles that you post are 10 to 15 foot tall. But we were talking at one time maybe they could have been gigantic. I mean, maybe even hundreds of feet. I mean, in the Book of Enoch, they talk about 450 L. What is an L exactly? Does anybody know how big an L is?
Nobody really knows what an L is. And so you've got two different translations of the Book of Enoch, one that comes out of the Ethiopian account, one that comes out of the Aramaic account, and one says cubit and one says L. But most of the consensus is it shouldn't have been a cubit, it should have been an L, but that doesn't answer any questions. But if it was a cubit size, now you're talking 400 feet. So I think I guess that's possible. I think that's probably a little bit large. but in the original creation, we don't know, right, in the first generation. What we do know is that other accounts that we have, we've got giants well accounted over 10 feet, and you've got King Og out of the biblical account as the last survivor of the Rephaim, which descend out of the Nephilim, and who somehow likely survives the flood. His bed was, if you're using a royal cubit because he was a king, was somewhere between 15 and 16 feet, and made of iron because his weight and size would crush wood, so they had to make it out of iron. So that would have put him 14 or 15 feet tall. That's probably the biggest account we get in the Bible of what he is, but there's another verse in the Bible that says they were like, this is in Amos, it says they were like the cedars of Lebanon, and those were 35 to 40 feet tall.
Yeah, well, even Goliath from the Bible was, I mean, he wore hundreds of pounds of armor, right? So like, he had to have been a gigantic.
Yeah, he's not the 8-foot giant or the 6-foot giant that some people talk about. So again, if you use the cubit length that's provided in the Bible and use it as a common cubit, which is only 18 inches as opposed to 21 inches for the royal cubit, he's still going to be over 9 feet tall. And if you use the royal cubit, he's going to be between 10 and 11 feet tall. I mean, this guy was a monster.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, some of the – before we get into the topic for tonight, we're, you know, just getting people up to speed with certain things. But even some of the accounts nowadays of the giants still being alive and fighting with our military out of Afghanistan and areas like that, and they're still described with the red hair, smelling like a skunk, having like a spear that's monstrous-sized spear that can spike a human on them possibly. And there was rumors coming out of Afghanistan a couple of years ago that a troop disappeared, a whole secret troop, and then they sent another troop to go find that troop, and they found remnants of bones and stuff in front of a cave. And then they went to approach the cave, and a huge giant came out with red hair and a spear. And even though they were trained soldiers – and they were trained for combat, that the movement and the speed of this giant immobilized them for a second, and they froze with fear. And he was able to spike one of them on a pole before they started shooting him. And they all were yelling, like, shoot him in the head, shoot him in the head. And I think they might have taken him down, but it's – yeah, I can't prove it. You know, it's just a story I heard.
Well, it was actually I listened to the radio interview on Coast to Coast on – because it's recorded. You can get it off the internet to download to listen to it. And I think it was Steve Quayle with George Newry, and they actually said they had the pilot that was flying one of the helicopters there.
Really?
And it's a very compelling interview, and the details are very detailed and bang on to what my research on giants would say, that if that happened, that should be the case. So if it is a hoax, it was a very well documented and planned hoax, because the details were extraordinary. So yeah, somebody can go Google that on Coast to Coast and still listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, even I know, coming out of Celtic lore, I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name right, but it's Cuchulainn. Mm-hmm. Cuchulainn. He was known to be like gigantic and had one like crazy eye, and his body would move inside his skin and all types of things. And this was a huge battle hungry giant, you know.
And do you know what? What order he was part of?
I know it came from like Lug or the sun god and Conchobar and all that. Conchobar or something like that?
Yes. But
that's the Ulster, the Ulster Wars, right?
Yeah, it was the Ulster order, but it has a couple other different names to it. And one of them was called the Order of the Red Branch.
Wow.
And it's part of the Red Branch cycle of Irish mythology, as they like to call it. And Fergus Roik was his mentor.
Yeah,
and Fergus's father was called, Ross the Red. And he's the one who, as I understood it, founds this order. But as with a lot of mythologies, some of the mythologies also will take that back a little bit. So again, we have this Clan Ruri, or this Order of the Red, and it's that red hair color that is you need to focus on here in the association with giants.
Yeah, and so they would be, so the blonde hair, blue eyes would be more of the Nordic giants.
Yes. So as
the Aryan, maybe.
Yeah. Exactly that. So, and as the mythologies go, is these Tuatha De Danann, which whom we're talking about, because Fergus and Cuala Chan were both descendants of the Tuatha De Danann.
Yeah, the heroes of the Danann's, right?
Yeah, the heroes of the Danann's.
Yeah.
Well, in their mythology, they both, and in several ways in Ireland, whether or not it's the Firbolg, or it's the Formorians, or it's the Tuatha De Danann, or it's the Meals of Pen, and several other waves. And they're all from this general area out of northwest Greece, northeast Greece and northwest Turkey, in the Black Sea area, in around maybe Troy and larger than that. They're known as Scythians and Sarmatians and Amazons. These are the waves of giants that migrate to Ireland that are documented in the Irish history books like La Borga Bala and all the different types of myths that you have coming out of Irish mythology. And so these are the red-haired ones that go up the Danube and into Germany and then over to Ireland and then back into England with like legends of Albion and Gog and Magog come from. And also ones also go up into Russia and into the Slavic countries and into Germany and into Norway and Sweden for those other legends of moving up the Danube. So they're connected, and they are the same types of people. They just have different colors of hair and red eyes. And those are the same descriptions that come out of Atlantis and Plato.
Yeah, totally. And even the Cyclops and the Fomorians and all these different groups of different stages and different intellect of giants even.
Well, yeah, because if you look at the Fomorians, they move over and migrate over, they actually come from Nemed in the mythology. And they're called the Nemedians or the Nemedians. And
that's they were like the farmers, right? The Fomorians are like agriculture ones and the farmers.
Yeah, and they were descendants of Japheth, as the mythology goes. But more likely Japhetus or Iapetus, which was a titan, as you get closer into the detail. But as that goes, is from a biblical perspective, the descendants of Japheth also moved to northwest Turkey and Scythia, and you have some names that show up like Gog and Magog, which are clear-cut giant names out of Greek mythology and are carried with them over to Britain. So I think if there was some human Japhethian bloodlines mixed in, they married into them these Tuatha De Danann in the northwest Scythia area, and some of them changed their names to take on the giant names because those are clear names that come out of prehistory.
Yeah, and that's what these titans and I feel Greek gods were. They were giants, up even to the goddess Diana and these other, you know, tales of gods and goddesses. I feel they were all giants and bigger stature, bigger intellect and more powers, and I feel that they're possibly, we are descendants of that. I mean, what would you call Noah then? Where does he fit in? Are we descendants of Noah? Is Noah related to these giants in any way?
No, Noah would not be related to the giants in any way. His genealogy, at least from a biblical perspective, the Gnostics would say that he was a giant, or that at least some of his sons were giants. But from a lineage perspective out of the Bible, his genealogy does not intersect with any of the giants.
So but would we be the descendants of Noah then?
Yes, we would be descendants of Noah, but as the generations unfold, and very early on, the descendants of Ham and the descendants of Japheth and some of the descendants of Shem, as in Esau and Amalek, they will intermarry in with the giants. So you start to get this intermixing of demigod, giant bloodlines, and human bloodlines, right? So you get this mixture, and that's why whether or not RH negative is from the giants or from aliens or wherever you want to come from, it is foreign to the blood. But in this line of thought, then that would say where 15% of the RH negative bloodlines come from.
That's
15% of the total bloodlines they represent. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, and you know, some people, you know, say that it's not possible for giants like that to have existed and stuff. And I'm saying there's from what we're showing you is documented proof. And from all the tales that go on and from us knowing that the fallen angels in the Book of Enoch came down and intermingled with women or did some sort of DNA experiment with our DNA, that these giants were formed, right? So that means that they're part, maybe have DNA, but they have part supernatural powers as well, and they're part more than us. So do you think that they're like sort of like part of what Semyaza or Azazel is, that they have this magic about them in their species and that they could be more than just physical form, that they might have like supernatural characteristics to them?
Well, I don't think the giants actually had that much for supernatural. They would have had probably some gifts other than just being of a larger size. We know that they were more fleet of foot, and more dexterous than and faster than humans were, and that comes out of the Greek accounts in particular, and which backs up what they're talking about in that Afghanistan interview.
Yeah.
If you listen to it, but did they have a changeling ability? We don't know that was there, that was passed on or not, because the gods certainly did. Them as demigods, were they smarter? It doesn't appear that they were smarter, but it was basically their physical capabilities that allowed them to take control of the various civilizations. But they did have, at least in the initial generation, an immortal spirit, and that spirit didn't go to sleep. And so when you hear about hero worship or the vagabond ghost spirits of Taoism, these are those spirits of those demigods that their body died or they committed suicide. They're in so much pain, but their spirits wouldn't go to sleep and they weren't permitted to go into heaven. So and in the fairy culture, that is what you would know as the banshees or the ghost spirits or the phantoms. And so, again, we get this consistency all the way through all the different cultures about a particular breed of beings called, you know, demigods, sons of gods and human females, and what happens to them, because they were giants and they rule, but they die eventually. And so then they have these spirits, and we have these spirits show up all over the world, and they're all traced back to the same group of demigods. But
like
above those, though,
like disembodied spirits, yeah.
Yeah, but above, though, you have two different sets of gods, and there's a, let's use Greek as the analogy. So you have Titan demigods or heroes, which are the giants, and then you have Titan gods. And typically the Titan gods are a lower level of god, and then you have the parent gods, right? So Titan gods might be looked on in this pantheon as Zeus and those seven major ones. Poseidon would be one of them, for example. And they're created from a parent set of gods above them, like Kronos and Gaia as examples, right? So, and how I relate that is that you have the original gods or fallen angels that are immortal, and they have shape-shifting abilities, and as they come into this world, they can be male or female in the physical world, and they can reproduce with themselves to produce the lower level, just as there's two types of jinn in the Quran, the ones created from smokeless fire, and then the other ones that people worshipped. So that would be maybe that second level of jinn that they're talking about, or the Olympus gods in this case, and then you have these gods also mating with human females to create the giant Titan demigods.
No, it's amazing. But this is, I have a theory. Like, I have a theory that all these beings are what magic, they have this magic, and they speak in spells and symbols and incantations, and they are where magic comes from. And I feel that these ancient beings, they exist in our psyche and in our eternal memory. They're in there. And then once we become aware of them and sort of like activate them in our memory and in our psyche, that they're able to appear on our physical plane. And when they appear, I feel that they're now subject to the physical plane rules. They need nourishment. They have a sexual appetite. They have certain desires, certain things that we have in our form, but they still have this sort of demigod abilities and powers. And I think that's how we have these tales of these huge giants ruling cities for a short period of time and then, you know, dying off, or, you know, all of a sudden they'll appear and they'll have to have the abilities of 700 men and eat seven cows and seven deer and in one sitting and all this shit stuff, because they're like in our, you know, plane now. They're on our physical plane, so now they have to abide by our rules of the physical plane and feed themselves. And I feel they still exist, and that they could possibly be awakening again, and that's why there's so much talk about giants. It's like it makes people excited to hear about it. It's in our eternal memory. It's like in us.
Yeah, although we come at it from, let's say, slightly different perspectives, I think you're bang on in your conclusions in terms of they do require a terrestrial sort of body for the dwelling place of their spirit. That word comes out of Greek is oikoteria, and out of Jude 1:6 biblically, where they left their habitation, which was a dwelling place for their spirit. So they need to be able to take on a physical form in this world, right? But once they do that, it seems you're so bang on that they take on almost human traits or the physical world traits, where they're no longer these maybe as godlike, that they actually start doing some bad things, because there's gods that are fighting all of the time, right? There's angels that are fighting all the time.
Yeah, and I think that we have certain technology, right? Like, we use technologies with weapons and different types of computers, but I think they have technology that seems like magic to us. It's with certain codes and certain spells that activate certain things on different planes of existence, you know, and certain things can form. And I think that's their technology, is through magic spells and these certain incantations. And we're just looking at it like it's magic, but it's actually a technology from their world or from who they are.
I agree. It's technology and knowledge.
Yep.
They understand everything about the universe, and they know how to manipulate it. They know how to access it, and they know how to use it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, to me, it's darkness. When you're using a spell or an incantation or certain symbols to make yourself more powerful or to achieve something that you shouldn't have got any other way but through a spell, then it's evil. You know, that's how I look at it. And even though certain things are in my family lineage with certain areas, I have my own theories and my own conclusions, and it doesn't sit right with me, all of those things. And even goes to Lake Nemi. And I know we got 4 minutes till break, and we'll get into the Lake Nemi and everything after break. But even with Lake Nemi, it's known as the Diana's Mirror. And Diana, you know, came from what my family lineage come. We get our knowledge from the Etruscans, and the Etruscans say they got it from the Persians, and the Persians say they got it from a star people. So it's like ancient tales that have been passed down. But in my family, they say that the Diana worship at Nemi came actually from Greece by Orestius and his sister Iphigenia or something. And then their homeland was being murdered, and they were being accused of being murderers. And so they came and they started a sacred grove near Nemi in honor of the goddess Diana. And the goddess Diana, to our my lineage, was a giant in all sense of the word. She was a giant. Her sexual appetite, her the way she ruled over people, the way she ruled over fairies. And she was not only the queen to the witches, but the queen of the fairies and of the forest. And when she would appear, it would be a loud, booming appearance, and she would appear over people, gigantic. So to me, she was a giant as well. I don't know where she fits in with the Nephilim lineage or anything like that, but...
And which name are you referring to on this one? Because there's a few different names that you use there.
Diana.
Oh, Diana. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the question gets to be is Diana actually a demigod and therefore appropriately titled Queen of the Spirits? Or is there other giants that maybe took the sort of Diana goddess and belief system with them to Nemi? And that's what is hard for me to separate, because Diana seems to be equated with Artemis and brother of Apollyon, or Apollo or Apollyon, depending on how you want to pronounce it, in both Roman and in Greece mythology. And those are the offspring of Zeus. So I'm wondering whether or not that goddess belief system was brought with them, or that was Diana actually just a demigod? It's hard to distinguish there for me from the two different types of mythologies, and not different types of mythologies, but different historical mythologies seemingly talking about a similar god at least.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too to note that, like, Diana had her consort Dionysus, right? The male.
Yes.
And he can also be considered the same person as Jupiter.
Yes.
And you know, so some That's people Zeus. Say that, you know, again, he was also known, Jupiter was known to be in tune with the oak tree. And there's a sacred oak tree with Lake Nemi that we're going to get back into after break for sure, because that's all ties into this and the sacred oak tree and the giants that would appear at Nemi in my family lore from this sacred oak tree to be the king of the forest or the Rex Nemerensis, where you would fight to be king for a year of the forest. And it's interesting, even with the giant Fergus, that Fergus gave his kingship up for 1 year to his wife's son, you know, or something like this, and it would, to rule for a year. So there's something about ruling for a year with these giants, and then you would have to battle the next year, that I've noticed a connection. And
like there can only be one.
Yeah, yeah, right? Like the Highlander. Yeah. So when we come back from break, everybody, if you're just joining us, we are with Gary Wayne from Genesis6Conspiracy.com, and you can find Spiral Radio right here on the Para X Radio Network and at the mysticalspiral.com. This song coming up is called Sonatas by Far Radio Clouds. We'll be back right after this, and Spiral out.
Anywhere. Thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X.
And we are back. And if you are just joining us, we are with Gary Wayne from Genesis6Conspiracy.com. And you can find his book, Genesis6Conspiracy, at that website and on Amazon. And you can find me at themysticalspiral.com. And I also have a show now on Saturday nights on the Truth Frequency Radio Network, TFR Live, and that show is called The Eye of Ra. And we're back with Gary. And Gary, you know, we were talking before break. We started to get into Lake Nemi, and and the Rex Nemerensis and what that is. And I'm interested to know what you have to add to that as well.
On the order there, Rex Nemerensis?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, my research, and I haven't done a lot of research into that aspect of it, but this was an order of, you know, that was representing two aspects. Again, you have, and it's not untypical whether or not it's the Tengu that are related to the Nagas, you have a creation of a warrior class, and you have a creation of a priest class, and yes. That this religion goes back, at least according to Ovid, back into very, very ancient times. So prehistory is the translation. And so this is, again, that sort of standard organizational structure all throughout prehistory, which is again, these just amazing parallels. So you have a structure of a king, you have a structure of a priest, and they represent the government, the military, the warriors, and the religious class, and those are usually demigods, and they are the representatives of the gods on this earth, and they report to higher gods and up to through a chain of higher gods as you go. And so they are the intermediaries, they're the messengers, the representatives, they have the divine right to rule, and they communicate with the gods regularly. So that's kind of how I understood that whole order, which seemed to be a standard type of thing that is recorded in history and prehistory.
Yeah, I mean, not to get into where my family too much goes, because my family was guarding secrets even involving this lake with possibly portals beneath it and all of this, but with the story of the Rex Nemerensis and the priesthood and the warriors, it goes very ancient, like you said. And basically, like what I said before, that it came over from Greece, and they established this sacred grove next to Nemi in honor of the goddess Diana. And along this grove grew this oak tree. And this oak tree, no branch was usually ever allowed to be broken off of it in any way. Only a runaway slave would be allowed to break off this branch, right? And if he actually did break off the branch, and he succeeded at breaking off the branch, he would be able to challenge the guardian of the grove in a ritual single combat. And if victorious, he then became the guardian of the woods, the king of the woods, the Rex Nemerensis. And because the guardian of the grove was an outlaw, he would wear like a hood all the time. He was known as the Hooded Man. And it was known that like the first challenger ever to enter the grove at Nemi was Diana had this person called Verbius, and Verbius was a giant from the solar gods, and he resided in this forest at Nemi, and it's said that this Verbius, he had offended Venus by rejecting her for the goddess Diana, so he was like a consort of Diana's, and he rejected Venus for her, and in return for favor from Diana, Verbius became the guardian of this grove at Nemi, and somebody was allowed to challenge him, this giant, every year if he was able to break a branch off this oak tree. And they always used like a runaway slave or an outcast or somebody not from the town, because this person would be always in the woods. He would not be with society. He would be hooded. And if he did defeat this giant, he would then take on abilities of the giant, like whenever he had a combat for the king of the woods, he would be able to have a gigantic appearance, and sort of like it manifested in him as a giant, and he would have to nourish himself and feed from and have sex with all these women. And it's almost the same tale as almost like Fergus, like we talked about. And you know, this is even the times of Caligula. Now Caligula was known to hire warriors to try to defeat the guardian of Nemi, and at this sacred grove, and you know, Caligula went mad trying to contact entities associated with this Lake Nemi, and the gods that you know were in the woods there. And I even feel that I'm interested to hear your opinion on this, Gary, too. Like even mountains, I think some ancient mountains might be burial mounds on top of ancient giants. What do you think about that?
Certainly a possibility. There's so many sacred mountains. Generally, when it's sacred, it's either where the gods are dwelling or it's a burial site. So there's a consistency to that aspect for sure. And certainly what's very interesting is how, whether or not it's the hood or whether or not it's the giants, whether or not it's the oak tree or the oak groves, or whether or not it is the river or the lake that has portals, that all transfers to England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland in their history and mythology, which is just an amazing sort of coincidence. And so if you take the people that we're talking about, this Fergus Roy, he basically was enormous and had the strength of like 700 men and had the virility thereof as well, as you were speaking. And his sword, the Caladab Bolg, was, he used to chop off the treetops. He was so big, right? And so, but let me just continue on a bit of this transfer, because he's Tuatha De Danann, as his history goes back, as we talked about. And so if we look at who creates the Tuatha De Danann, they come from the male god Dagda and the female god Danu, as most people sort of say it and pronounce it. But, and these are the fairy people, and they're very fair skinned, just as we talked about this pale white skin earlier in the show.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Tuatha De Danann, that means the tribe of Daana, right? As you could pronounce it, it can be pronounced D-A-A-N-A or D-A-A-N-U, as it would be Danana. So it has a very similar sort of enunciation. And what's also interesting is Daana is the fertility god of divine water, just as you were talking about, and of the oak tree as it transcends. Now, also part of the Tuatha De Danann lore are the fairy people, which the Tuatha De Danann are one of the numbers of the fairy people, and there's four different categories of fairies. There's giants, there's elementals, which are small ones, there's banshees and daemons and ghost spirits, and then there's also the gods, right? So there's four different classifications there. And the fairy folk, the ladies of the lake, and nymphs are all part of the Diana religion and people that are around her, and I think partially created by her as well, but there's different ways that they're created. But in Celtic lore, the ladies of the lake, as in King Arthur, or fairies are in lakes, because that's where the portals are, in the rivers, in the lake. So you have another direct connection there. And Diana, or Danu, as she's called in Irish mythology, was called Dian the Shea, S-I-D-H-E, which means portal.
Wow.
So again, you get another direct connection there.
Yeah.
And then as we come down through a little bit more on history, you have like King James the VI. He wrote a book in 1597 before he moves down to England as James the I. And he names in his book Daemonology, which is the same terminology that you use. It's D-A-E-M-O-N as opposed to D-E-M-O-N, which is the spirit that is used in polytheism. And he calls Diana the queen of the fairies.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Shakespeare, in Midsummer's Night Dream, he writes about fairies and things like crazy in there, right? It's this real fantasy sort of thing that most people think it is, but it's based on real history. And King Oberon is a king of the fairies. And Oberon comes from a Scythian and Tuatha De Danann root, and most people don't know that, and it comes from the word Uper and Overon, as it comes of the Tuatha De Danann. So Scythian is the Uper, and stands for Overlord.
Okay, wow.
So these are kings, right? So, and this is the king of the fairies, Oberon, and as he goes back into mythology, that's also written about before that as Oberon being king of the fairies. But his wife is named Titania, which is, you know, a female giant, right? And it's an epithet of Diana. I always have trouble with that word. I trip over my tongue.
Yeah.
And of course, she's married to Oberon, so that makes her queen of the fairies. And she's eternally young and beautiful as that epithet. So you have these consistencies that come down through history, and then you have an occult literature that says Diana is the ruler of the fairies, and she's the queen of the witches, and queen of the spirits, and queen of the Tuatha De Danann, or the mother goddess, and in the Wicca, and also queen of the witches, and in the Wicca, Diana is equated with Isis, Inanna, Ishtar, Abnoba, and those Nakate, are all
them,
all of fertility woodland goddess, just as the god that is generally associated with them is another woodland type god. And all of a sudden that brings, and again, I don't know how CERN in Etruscan mythology goes back to Diana, or whether or not they're related, but he's also a woodland god, right?
Yeah, CERN and Ceronios
and Apollyon and Azazel and Pan and on and on. So you have this connection that just seems to come down all of the time that's just absolutely consistent in seemingly what we're taught in school is unrelated cultures and pantheons, which all of a sudden you say, wait a minute. There's no way that could happen if that was the case. So they're obviously related. And I think this all goes back to that ancient sort of creation of the giants and the prehistorical world and what happened after the rebellion in the prehistoric world and in the Greek mythology. They're put into Tartarus, which is a prison for the rebellious giants. And giants like Hercules and Theseus, they fight against the evil giants for Zeus.
Yeah.
And they check the warring titans that are coming from Poseidon's Atlantean Empire of 10 ruling states. So it's more than just a continent, and there's 10 giant titan kings that are twins, so five sets of twins.
Yeah, even Nemi is known as Diana's mirror. I mean, that's what he's known at, yeah.
And a mirror is just another allegory, as is a looking glass to go through a portal into another dimension, right? Yeah. Just as, the other world is, Tartarus is. And after the flood, these giants escape out of Tartarus somehow, some way. And these are the ones that come out in northwest Turkey, where all of the Scythian and Sarmatian sort of connection comes back to the Tuatha De Danann that we had talked about. And these were basically known as the lizard people or the snake people or the dragon people.
Naga, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So it's just so many interesting connections as you go down the line here.
Yeah, so many. So do you think maybe even, and this might be a little off topic, but do you think that maybe even Göbekli Tepe is related to these giants, these ancient monuments, these massive stones, these carvings?
Did you say Zep Tepe?
No, Göbekli Tepe. It's like a...
That's a place in Turkey. And that goes back far beyond secular history's accountability of when it should show up. Yeah. I think that goes back to like those ancient cities of Sumeria. I think it would be similar to that in probably 4 to 9 ancient civilizations. But in all mythologies around the world, and again, whether or not it's the ancient city of Uruk or any of the ancient Sumerian cities, and Machu Picchu or other places around the world, all of the history that comes out of these people and cultures is that sometime around 10,000 BC, the gods built great cities, and then at some point in time later, humans will inherit them as the gods bring them in to civilize them and teach them knowledge and farming and stuff like that, say 4,000 to 5,000 BC in that zone. And then humans start to build for the gods from the knowledge that they're providing them. They may not do it quite as well, but they're still building with a technology that's unaccountable. So do I think Göbekli Tepe is part of that? I guess the simple answer is yes.
Yeah, I would say so too.
And underground, a lot of it is.
Yeah. I mean, they've only uncovered about 10% of it, I think.
Yeah, and just as I think as we talked on another show, there's so many underground cities that people don't know about, right? So...
Yeah, I mean, there might even be a whole interdimensional portal network that we don't know about within Earth. You know, it's the possibilities are endless. And So do you feel that, you know, you're aware of like the 72 lesser keys of Solomon and Goetia. Do you think that these are the disembodied spirits of these Nephilim?
Yes. I think all of the demons, as we would know it in Christianity, and most people understand what a demon is, that is the bodiless spirit of a demigod.
Wow. So,
and
like,
I would look, and I was going to say, and I place, from a Christian perspective, fallen angels and or gods and or other technologically advanced beings, depending on what perspective that you're coming from, they're different than the demons.
So we have in the chat room someone, you know, asking, you know, no mass panic happened, they said, when the dinosaurs were discovered. Why would the existence of giants be kept secret? And before you answer, I would like to say that, you know, because it would change everything about our history. You know, yes. Which, you know, and I'm interested to think how you would answer that.
Well, because they're controlling the information, and they're going to bring all of this out at a time when they want to bring it out. But in the meantime, the information is being controlled. And so there's a completely different history than what they're currently teaching in school. They probably will get rid of the evolutionary theory, which is mathematically impossible anyways, and bring out their true belief system in terms of, you know, who actually created the dinosaurs, why they were created in that Saurian reptilian sort of look, because it probably represented the beings that created them, the gods, and or the seraphim angels from the monotheist perspective, and before Genesis 2. And that's a whole different show in itself. But it's about controlling the information, and everything is about control.
Yeah, it really is. And there, I think that like what we alluded to at the beginning of the show is that these bloodlines sort of still control the earth in a way. These descendants of the Nephilim in a way, and. Do you feel that the elites, certain kings, queens that still exist out there, they're aware of their bloodline?
Oh, absolutely. They have the genealogies that go right back to the Nephilim and the gods.
And these secret societies basically are continuing the magic or technologies of these ancient gods.
Yeah. So and they keep it in front of our noses all of the time.
Yeah.
So, and there's an interesting movie out just lately about King Arthur. Well, what's interesting about King Arthur is that he is a descendant of the Tuatha Dé Danann.
Yes,
that we were just talking about, right? And he's a Pendragon, and he's the son of Uther Pendragon, and his mother is a fairy as well, which is that fairy Tuatha Dé Danann. Just as Guinevere is a fairy phantom, and it all comes out of those two allegories, and the allegories are the dragon and the raven are the patriarchal or the male bloodlines, and the fairy and the owl are the allegories for the matriarchal bloodlines. And this is all reflected in King Arthur. And there are a heck of a lot more genealogies in there than this. I mean, Gawain is son of the King of Lot in Sweden. And this now connects. Yeah, this is a table of heroes at a round table of not knights, kings, this warrior class that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
And you've got names like Hebron and Bron, which is the connection there. Of course, Hebron is the Kiriath Arba ancient name, which was the capital city for the giants of the covenant land of the Middle East. And again, all of that gets encoded in there, just as you get the Scythian bloodlines from Alan's side as well, through names like Elaine and so many other ones. And again, you can do a show just on the different names and things that are encoded on King Arthur. And then you have another connection of Arthur back to Fergus, because Fergus had this sword that was called the Caled Bolg, right?
Yeah.
And that's defined as, this is very interesting, I thought, was, and it's also called the Caled Fuich. And again, I'm probably butchering the enunciation of ancient Gaelic, but The meaning of the word Caladbolg is that it is a lightning sword.
Wow, they said his sword was like as long as a rainbow or something too. I read that somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's referred to as the rainbow sword. It's as long as a rainbow, and of course, rainbow is an allegory of the flood, right? So yeah. Again, you get that connection back into prehistory, and the sword in King Arthur in some narratives is called the alternative name to Caladbolg, and it's called Caladfuch, and that's the sword of King Arthur. And so King Arthur's Excalibur sword, comes from a word, Celtic word, that's Calibur or Caliburn, and that goes back to Scythian historical etymology roots. So again, all of this is just encoded in King Arthur, and it's just amazing the amount of things that are in King Arthur. And of course, there are so many fairies in King Arthur, like the ladies of the lake guarding the portals.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Morgan Le Fay, which is Morgan the fairy. It's just all of the stuff is just interweaving in there. So
yeah, and that's the same thing with Nemi, with the Lady of the Lake. I mean, it's almost the same story, just with different, you know, it's amazing that this is going on. And it's like they took their stages in different ends of the world, and you have tales of different people or whatever.
Yep. And if you look at the translation for the land which King Arthur ruled over, that's called the Land of Magic, out of the fairy mythology. And Guinevere, I mean, that literally translates as white fairy or white phantom or white daemon spirit. So Gwyn is Welsh for fair, as in fair skin. And the balance of the name derives out of the Twilith Teg aspect of it, but it becomes a white phantom. So
wow.
Fair
and
phantom.
That's interesting, because too, like the sanctuary of Diana, that next to Nemi, was also home to a nymph called Egeria, and Egeria was the Lady of the Lake at Nemi, and she was, you know, connected with the lake, but also with like waterfalls and streams, and in Vestal virgins in Rome collected water from a sacred stream called to Egeria, and the temple, and they used to wash with the water the temple of Vesta. So it's it goes into many different aspects with this lake, and even Nemi is it's an ancient volcanic crater with ancient memory water and ancient portals that reside there, and you know the Owlbound Hills alongside of the Lake Nemi is ancient mountains with ancient lore as well, and you know all of outlaws and outcasts and people would gather there and be protected by the goddess Diana and the lake and the guardian of the woods. So a lot of people that were outcasts of patriarchal society, they would gather at Nemi and they would praise these giants and these ancient gods.
Yeah, yeah. So again, you're talking about rituals and understandings and religion that is so similar. They have to be connected because you just can't account for it, you know, any other way.
Yeah. And, you know, the Egeria stream, they said, would bubble from the roots of the sacred oak at Nemi. And because oak burns at a higher temperature than most of the wood, it was used in ancient times to heat the forge from which the swords for these giants were produced.
Yeah. Yeah. And typically in Norse mythology, you're going to have, again, as I said, there's three classes of the elementals. And one is the gnomes. And the gnomes keep track of the technology.
Yeah.
And the knowledge and the genealogies. And they're part of the ugly group, as opposed to the mischievous and the pretty ones. And then as you go dig deeper on that, is you get like out of the Norse mythology, you have the dwarves who live in the earth and mountains and make the weapons for the giants.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, Gary, we're going to have you back on in October. So, I mean, once again, an hour is just never enough. And everybody, you can find Gary Wayne at Genesis6Conspiracy.com, and you can find us on Podomatic, and you can find us on TheMysticalSpiral.com and here on Para X Radio. And we'll be back next week, and we'll say once again, thanks again. And I want to thank Gary. Thank you for having coming on again. I want to thank you, and I want to thank my producer, Sarge, and Para X Radio. And once again, I say, Spiral out.
Your iris on me.